The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Dan Porterfield, president and CEO of the Aspen Institute, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving on AM 970 The Answer WNYM in New York City.
The most significant breakthroughs to solving social problems are not coming out of any one field or place, but rather are occurring at the intersections of different areas of study, different geographies, different life experiences. It is this cross-fertilization that allows us to reframe problems that can lead to novel solutions. No single organization resides at these intersections any more squarely than does the Aspen Institute. And it's a pleasure to have with us tonight their president and CEO, Dan Porterfield. Good evening, Dan, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening, Denver. Thanks so much for having me.
You know, the Aspen Institute, oh my, 70 years old. So let's start at the beginning by having you share with us its founding story and how it came to be.
The Aspen Institute came to be in 1949 when a Chicago business leader named Walter Pepke had a vision that it was important to create in a new part of the country that wasn't particularly developed, a retreat environment where leaders could gather to talk about the critical issues of the day. And Pepke was inspired in part by the strength of America in winning World War II. And he also was aware that the very bedrock of civilization had been shaken to the core by Nazi Germany, and that it was critical to put in place the informed and engaged leaders who would make sure that the bonds of citizenship would hold up under pressure in the United States. He also had an enlightened vision that business leaders were very much responsible for the overall social well-being of the country in which they made their living. And out of that vision, the Aspen Institute has become a great convening and leadership development organization, evolving every 10 years or so as society's needs change, but always about gathering people together for important conversations about how to ensure that our country is a free, just, and equitable society.
Yeah, it's amazing how the DNA of an organization is really baked in at the very beginning, because what you just said that occurred 70 years ago is as relevant, if not more so today, than it was back then.
Isn't it? And the thing of what I just said, free, just, and equitable society. Those are big concepts. What does it mean to have freedom in our country? How do we ensure that each citizen, each resident is able to develop his or her talents to the fullest and live and express their freedoms as an equal citizen? What does justice mean? How do we ensure that we have rule of law in our country, that our laws are developed with institutions that are working and that are accountable to the public? And then this idea of an equitable society, with so many changes in the way people work, in the nature of the national and the global economy, how do we make sure that work still pays and that it makes sense for people to set goal to be able to take care of their family through a job that comes both with a decent salary and with decent health care, child care, and other benefits? And these are questions that every era of Americans will need to deal with. Free, just, and equitable is baked into the core of the American democratic system. And it's also baked into the core of the Aspen Institute as a leadership organization.
Let me pick up on something you said a moment ago, and that is being a great convening organization. Because a number of people, David Brooks of the New York Times among them, who we'll speak about in a moment, has said it is the greatest convening organization in the world. Is this simply reputation, Dan, or are there certain things that you do, an art of getting people together from completely different ends of the spectrum and getting them to engage in constructive and respectful conversation?
Well, I think there's a lot of common sense that comes in good convening. For example, it's important that everybody on stage, if that's how you're speaking in a group on stage, everybody agrees that they will answer the question that's asked, that they will listen to and respect each other's views, that they will try to speak from a base of evidence and not just misstate, sort of facts in order to justify a point of view, that the questioner herself or himself will be unbiased and objective, and that the process of dialogue or debate ends with each side acknowledging the other's points of view, even if they disagree, or especially because they probably will disagree. And the Asp Institute believes that as a society, we don't need fewer arguments. We need better arguments.
Yes. Well, I got to tell you, those are very simple common sense ground rules, but so few people ever follow them.
I think sometimes if we can just step back and remember what, the role models in our lives when we were children taught us, whether they were teachers or an aunt or uncle or a parent or older sibling, when someone just said to you, hey, listen to what the other person is saying.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, can you just open your mind up for a moment? Or, hey, I know you can say it that way, but you don't have to. How can you say it more politely? Just that basic decency that we learned growing up, and so many of us, needs to be applied in the public space today.
Yeah, I think everybody's thinking about what they're going to say.
That's
next,
true.
And not listening to what the person is saying to them.
That's a good point. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, I said before that the Aspen Institute is noted for framing issues in new ways, and that's the way we come to find some completely new and different solutions. That's a wonderful attribute in which to have. I always see a problem. I try to solve it right away, and I go down the same dead end probably that everybody else has gone down before. How do you reframe an issue, and maybe you give us an example of a case where Aspen Institute has done that with a good ending?
Oh, thank you. So let me give an example first. We have a program at the Aspen Institute that's called the College Excellence Program, led by a guy named Josh Weiner. And Josh has been working on a program that's called the American Talent Initiative, which is funded by Bloomberg Philanthropies here in New York City. And the goal of the American Talent Initiative is to make it possible for more high-achieving, lower-income, and moderate-income students to go to top schools with high graduation rates. There's a lot of those kinds of schools in New York, Columbia, Fordham,
yep,
NYU, et cetera. And the College Excellence Program worked to make it possible for 110 of America's top colleges, including the whole Ivy League, and many of those bigger public institutions that serve lots of kids, like Ohio State or mm-hmm. University of Texas, to all join together to set a national goal that collectively we would enroll 50,000 more low and moderate income students who are very deserving, very talented, in any of these schools that have a high graduation rate. And so what Josh was able to do, supported by Mike Bloomberg's foundation, was to get these top schools not to compete against each other for rankings or bowl game wins or whatever, but to compete together to help our country by making sure that lower and moderate income kids know the doors are open to them. So that was his first reframing, was to turn competition into cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
His second reframing was to frame it as a talent initiative, which is so important because if you think about a lower moderate income student from the perspective of being talented, having a lot to offer, having earned opportunity to go to a great school but not having the door open, that really makes it a national issue to make it possible for more of our great future leaders to get the opportunity to go to top schools. And so by framing it and understanding it as talent or reframing it, Josh helped motivate a lot of schools to say, we want to be a part of that. We want to help more talented students get the opportunity they've earned. So that's an example of reframing. Now, what does it take to reframe? I think people do it all the time, like when they're raising their kids, and you sort of think to yourself, how do I get my child to understand something really important? Like, let's say that tobacco is bad for you. It's bad to start smoking. So a parent's thinking, well, if I talk to my child like I'm talking to an adult, my child may not hear me.
Mm-hmm.
And so a parent thinks, well, what will my child hear? And maybe instead of putting out health statistics on addiction, a parent just says to their child, tobacco is a thief. Tobacco steals your money. It steals your health. It steals your looks. That's reframing. We all do it all the time.
Yeah.
So what does it take to reframe? I think it takes an open mind and most of all, trying to think about any problem from another person's perspective. Because if you think about it only from your own perspective, you're just pitching. You need to pitch it so they can catch it. And so that's the most important thing.
Empathy.
That's a good way to put it.
Put yourself in their shoes and what is going to reach them. And as you say, when you make the tobacco companies this evil empire enemy, it changes everything as opposed to me trying to tell my kid not to smoke, which makes it even more enticing.
I also think that if you're going to reframe a problem, think about a problem in a new ways, it takes a little bit of humility to be willing to change your own previously held views. And I've changed my views on things over time. And I think that if you just think to yourself, okay, am I sure I need to hold that view forever? Sometimes it becomes quite easy to reframe an issue for yourself, which is the first step to reframing for others.
Give me an example of something you've changed your mind about in the last 10 years and why.
Well, one is about the drinking age. I really think that our country would be better served by experimenting with a model of allowing younger people who are 18, 19, or 20 to be able to have a learner's permit to drink beer or wine. They could lose their learner's permit if they drove with any alcohol in their system or if they committed a crime and had alcohol in their system. Maybe they could only purchase beer or wine from a certified sort of licensed establishment like their college or the military if they're in service. But I think it would be better for public health if younger people who can vote and who can work and do all sorts of other things could learn how to drink wine or beer socially. I didn't always hold that view.
Yeah.
But I came to hold that view when I, as a college president, noticed how many 18, 19, and 20-year-olds were, in fact, drinking kind of under the table before events or were finding a way to get into bars with fake ID cards. And I just wished I could instead serve them beer or wine on campus legally because they had a learner's permit. Of course, we never did that. But if we could do that, I thought it might have good public health outcomes.
That's very interesting.
That's an example of a change of perspective.
It's sort of embracing the gray. And we have everything in the society is black and white. You can drink or can't drink. But, you know, sometimes embracing the gray a little bit and having that malleability in the middle can serve everybody's best interests.
Well, the thing about the learner's permit that could be good is it recognizes that there's different levels of maturity around 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. And some 18-year-olds are like 50-year-olds. They're so mature. They've handled so much responsibility. They've held big jobs. They're in the military, for goodness sakes, defending our country. Others maybe just haven't yet had the maturity to really be able to handle that, and they would not be able to keep a learner's permit then.
You know, when you came to Aspen, you had a number of big objectives. One of them was to extend your reach. Another was to be more bold and audacious. And still another was to increase the organization's impact. And let me pick up on that one. Dan, how does an organization like the Aspen Institute go about measuring your impact?
That's such a great question. We have about 60 different programs, and some of them are leadership programs where you're working with individual cohorts of, say, 15 or 20 mid-career adults who are looking to take their work to the next level of significance. We're also running education programs for people of all ages. We conduct studies to see if certain kinds of practices in education or in the workplace are working. We have all these different ways that we work, and there's not going to be one way to measure impact across the different methodologies we have. But I think that, first of all, one of the benefits of caring about impact is it puts a little bit of an incentive then to ask before you start doing your work, well, what's my goal? If ahead of time you're able to express the goal you have, whether as a teacher or as a coach or as a program leader, as an employer, if you know what your goal is, it becomes easier then to see if you're making progress. Secondly, I think that when organizations receive money, whether from donors or from the government, it's important to be able to say to your generous people that are investing in you, hey, here's what we're trying to accomplish. For example, we're trying to help find the next generation of leaders in community colleges, because if we can really work with those future community college presidents, so those presidents learn some of the techniques for getting higher graduation rates and getting their two-year graduates into either transfer positions at four-year colleges or jobs that pay, we can do a lot of good in society. Well, there's a lot you can measure in that. You can measure are the people you're finding going on to get those presidencies of community colleges. Is the work they're doing at those community colleges then increasing graduation rates, increasing postgraduate employment? It's not the only thing to value, but it's important to measure what you can.
Yeah, yeah. I find it sometimes when you have to write something down as opposed to say it and have to distribute it to somebody, it really gets you to think a lot harder about exactly what you're trying to do.
Now, of course, some forms of benefit are not as easily measured. For example, if you ask me some important questions and I reflect on them and 2 years later my mind has changed a little bit, that may be a harder thing to assess.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you and I have worked together with like a two businesses, a college and a church, all to help fix a neighborhood. Well, which one had the biggest impact? Hard to say. So I think you can get a little crazy trying to find every impact, but it's good to measure what you can.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we mentioned David Brooks before, and I said we would return to him. And I, like millions of others, read him in the New York Times a couple times every week.
He's brilliant.
And I didn't realize a lot of what he's been doing now, he has been doing in concert with the Aspen Institute. Share with our listeners exactly what that is.
So David Brooks came to the Aspen Institute about 7 or 8 months ago with an idea. He said, as much as I love writing columns in the New York Times, I would like to try to make a bigger, deeper impact in America. And by going around the country and meeting individual women and men who are change makers in their communities and who have brought about change, not by dividing people, but by bringing us together. And he was acting on an intuition that there's something beautiful and civic-minded in the soul of America that we need to go find and allow ourselves to see again in our neighborhoods, in our communities, at the grassroots and individual level. David had this sense that if he could get out across the country and be able to meet people, that whether they're doing it through interreligious dialogue programs or education programs or violence prevention programs or the programs that bring together people of different political philosophies, if he could find the people that are trying to heal the divides, that are trying to reweave the fabric of community. And then if he could put a spotlight on those everyday heroes and heroines and find the themes that they all believe, he could perhaps elevate their collective voices through his columns and through some convenings that we're doing together at the Aspen Institute. And that's exactly what he's done. Whether it's a young man who's working to empower urban youth in Washington, D.C., or a Methodist minister in New Orleans who's opening up her home to anyone in the community that wants a place to go, to a man in Chattanooga who's got the whole city talking about one Chattanooga. David's finding people of all these different backgrounds all about the same thing, bringing community together. His hope is that he could even turn them into a national force because the power of their example is so great. And one of the things that he's told all the different audience he's spoken to is that what we can learn from everyday people that are making a difference in everyday communities is, one, they want to solve problems. Two, they have a calling and a sense of humility.
Mm-hmm.
And three, they have chosen this way to work as an alternative to some other aspect of society they didn't want a part of. They walked away from a job or from a fight or from a way of viewing the world in order to have this embracing humanistic vision. Now, that's what David's doing. And that's what the Aspen Institute is really about. It's about finding people that want to make communities strong again.
You know, a couple of remarkable things about that. Number one, I didn't realize he recruited you as opposed to you recruiting him.
He came to us.
You know, which is,
exactly.
Which is crazy. And I think the other thing is that exactly what we need right now, because the diet we're being fed by the media is so depressing and is such bad news. And I talk to so many people and I ask them why they're so stressed and so anxious and just feel the way they feel, really depressed.
Denver,
it's
you're so right.
Because everything we get from 11 to 11:30 is just a horror show, and it's not representative of what's going on in this country.
I think that's the key point. That somehow it's almost as if we need a new media focus or channel, a whole new ethos, where we're somehow going to make it possible for people to see and believe that there are the norm across our country, especially at the local levels, is people trying to make life better and connecting to each other, not wanting to engage in, you know, partisanship that turns the other side into your enemy.
Yeah. And I know part of your vision is you'd love to see the Aspen Institute eventually become a media company in a number of years.
It would be interesting if we could find some way to fund ourselves without advertising.
Yeah.
So that our job would be to aggregate, bring together the stories that everybody else is telling, local newspapers around the country, which are under so much pressure, or local radio or public television or the foundation world that's funding different kinds of ways of helping communities. If we could sort of be an outlet that brings it all together, a go-to place to learn about who's working to make a difference in America, why does it matter, and who are the people involved, I think we'd do a lot of good. I realize that I'm probably right now just fantasizing a little bit.
But that's
where it starts.
You know, as we mentioned before, the Aspen Institute has some 60 programs, and I'm just going to pick one arbitrarily because I'm really interested in it, and that's your arts program, which is now being led by the former executive director of the Signature Theater here in New York. What role, Dan, do the arts and culture play in bringing about social change? Yeah.
That's such a great question. Erica Mallon, when she was the leader of the Signature Theater, helped to develop a program in which the everyday public could afford to bring their children to the theater. The ticket pricing was worked out in a way that really worked for families. And that's one thing, is to make art accessible. I also think that art allows people to express themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we express ourselves both through art and by interpreting art. My brother's name is Matthew Porterfield. He's a filmmaker, an independent filmmaker. And so his films don't go into big cineplexes, but they're very fine independent films about everyday people in Baltimore, where he lives. In one of his movies, which is called Putty Hill, all the people in the movie just about are real people, and Matthew built the parts around them. They're everyday people. And then in the movie, they all are doing different things that are artistic. One is a tattoo artist. One is a woman who plays guitar at her house. One is a kid whose artistry is on the skateboard. Another is a young man who we don't know him as a character, but he does graffiti. And the point of all that is that what Matthew was saying is that in this particular working class community, there's art everywhere.
Yeah.
People are expressing themselves. It's a universal feeling, a yearning to express oneself. I also think there's a benefit for society when an art form can allow us to discuss or debate ideas by talking about the art form as opposed to directly engaging the ideas. It's almost like it throws your glance off to the side. So, for instance, a movie like Do the Right Thing by Spike Lee, one of the great New York movies, really got people talking about race relations and about the legacy of historical racism and sort of the structural impediments that can keep people apart from one another. I'm not sure if that was a hopeful movie or not. I didn't see it as a hopeful movie, but I do think it was a helpful movie because it got people talking.
Yeah, and I mean, these artists are such great social entrepreneurs, and I think what they do is they touch a different part of our brain than the things that we normally consume, but they have a hard time getting the kind of venture capital or, you know, venture philanthropy that people who are trying to solve poverty and a whole bunch of other things so readily are eligible for. They're kind of off to the sides, and that doesn't really make much sense.
It takes work to stick with one's artistic vision when there's not a lot of funding for it. I know this well because my brother Matt, left NYU after 3 years because he was ready to make a movie, and then he waited tables and he took on every odd job he could over 5 years so that he could buy each piece of equipment needed each step of the way.
Yeah.
But that's good for him, too. Although it was hard, it took a long time. The movie that came out of that, which was called Hamilton, was actually reviewed in The New Yorker. And Richard Brody called it a masterpiece. It didn't come out of a Hollywood studio. Yeah. It didn't have $100 million behind it. It had about $100,000 behind it, saved up over 5 years. And I don't think Matthew would change a thing from the way he has made film. But I think that the arts community in general, the arts community serves a democracy incredibly well because it reminds us of the eminence of each person's perspective and also of the critical importance of freedom of speech and freedom of expression.
You give a lot of thought to leadership. how that concept of leadership is changing and evolving. Goodness knows a guy like Vince Lombardi would not be very successful in the world of 2019. Tell us how you think about leadership and then how you put it into practice in your role of leading the Aspen Institute.
I do think leadership is a complicated term, and I think everybody can be a leader because everybody can be a role model to others. Isn't that what a leader really is? Someone whose example inspires other people to give or do their best. Sometimes the people that want to be leaders think it's all about the title, or it's all about winning the election or getting the promotion. But in fact, the everyday leaders in our lives, the ones that are in our brains from childhood forward, the ones who do the right thing, who ask the right questions, who carry themselves as models of integrity, which means their actions are like lined up with their values.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are the real leaders in society. So for me, a lot of the people I would call leaders are students I actually have taught, because in teaching those students, I came to recognize their journey for learning and their desire to honor their families and their hope to contribute to our country. And in that way, they were leading me to be the better teacher than I might have been if I hadn't had them as my students.
You are deeply committed to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I think that was made evident by your time at Franklin and Marshall, where I think your Pell Grants tripled
over the
course of 4 years.
Team effort, by the way.
Boy, I speak with so many nonprofit leaders who are working hard on this issue within their own organization, but are really frustrated at the slow pace of progress. Is there a way for them to look at this, well, opportunity that would be helpful for them to adopt?
I don't want to hold myself out as having every answer, but the main one is to work in partnership with the organization that you're a part of, everyone, so that your organization collectively can ask the question, how can a more inclusive workforce or student body serve our mission as an educational institution or as a company, as a nonprofit organization? Would we do better as a company with a more diverse workforce? Would we have a deeper and richer educational experience with more backgrounds in the classroom? As a nonprofit, would we serve a diverse and demographically changing nation with a more diverse employee base? Start with that question. How might diversity enhance your mission? If you can't answer that question well, learn from others that are like your organization. Mm-hmm. Well, how are they seeing it? I think that's the first thing.
Yeah, and I think what you just said along with that, too, it's not a problem to be solved.
Yeah, you live it.
It's an opportunity to be grabbed. And really just changes, as you say, this is a way we can become better.
Yeah, that's what we've been talking about at the Aspen Institute. And some of the things that we've, as a group, all employees, we had a whole town hall meeting on this topic not too long ago. Some of the things that some of my colleagues suggested, for example, is that we should be thinking about the surveys we do. And if the wording of the surveys is approachable to a diverse audience taking the surveys, we should also be thinking about how, when we interpret our surveys, are we interpreting them in partnership with the people that we're surveying? Which is interesting. If you're asking low-income people about a service you're providing, are you giving them a chance to give you their feedback on what it was they said? And then another really important thing was a concept called co-creation that some of our programs use, which is a term that just means, if you're working on an anti-poverty program, are the people at the table with your program leaders the people benefiting from the program? Our program on Native American youth, which is led by a colleague named Eric Stegman, is amazing at partnering with Native American students to design the very activities of the program. So my point is, I guess, that I don't think of diversity simply in one level, like it's just about ethnic identity or gender. Those are critical things. Nor do I think about diversity just numerically. If we can just hit a certain percentage of the workforce, well, we've won, right? You never win. I think, rather, what diversity and inclusion is about serving the mission of your organization. And can your organization proudly claim that it's always moving even further forward to being the best organization it can be? And if the answer is that's your goal, to be the best, then you will constantly live the question of how to engage our diverse world and your diverse customers or stakeholders in a way that most respects who they all are.
Very well said. You're a pretty big-time enterprise. You have a budget of around $150 million. Dan, what's the business model for the Aspen Institute? Who are your key partners, your key supporters?
Well, we have about 60 different programs that serve a whole wide range of communities. We have, for example, we have a great program on rural economic development mm-hmm. that's really led by Janet Topolsky. It's making a difference all across the country. We have a program called Ascend, which focuses on thinking about the amelioration of poverty, the prevention of poverty, through the lens of the whole family, rather than just working with the parent or just working with the children. It's a family approach, a two-gen approach to preventing poverty, led by a woman named Ann Mosley. And so we have a lot of programs where there's a great deal of direct service to actual human beings who are our partners in making the programs work. And then we have other programs that are about working with leaders to help leaders prepare themselves to accept the responsibilities of making a still bigger impact. And then, so how does all that get funded? Well, it's a combination of donations from private individuals, mm-hmm. Grants from foundations like the Ford Foundation or the Gates Foundation. And then there's also some government funding that we get. The State Department funds one of our programs, which is to do long-distance education for that brings together American students with students in North Africa and the Middle East online, you know, for so and through through technology. And then some of our programs are funded by a charge. We pay people to take part in our leadership programs or to attend some of our ideas festivals. And it's not one way that we're funded, which is better.
Oh, absolutely. It's healthy to have a number of different streams of revenue.
Well, that's one of the things that actually is hurting colleges and universities mm-hmm. is that they are so dependent on tuition revenue that they don't have other sources of revenue. And so they don't know how to deal with the increasing costs except by passing on the costs in the form of tuition increases.
Yeah.
And it's hard to say that they don't have increasing costs when they have such technology needs or such significant employees that need their health care covered and need so the cost of living to go up. So more what they call diversification of revenue streams, the better, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Let's talk a little bit more about your corporate culture. Every organization has its unique DNA at its core. How would you describe the corporate culture, the organizational culture at the Aspen Institute, and maybe some other ways what you do to try to influence it and shape it?
Thank you. That's one of the things I love most is trying to be a participant in and a contributor to a positive workplace culture, whether the workplace is a classroom or a team or a nonprofit or a university.
Makes all the difference.
Yeah. I've only worked in nonprofits, so I have in educational institutions. But I think that our culture is one that's positive and collaborative, results-oriented, nonpartisan, which is critical.
Mm-hmm.
I think also we're optimistic and we're creative. Now, among the things I'm working to do is to give the 400 or so employees of the Aspen Institute more opportunities to be together and talk about the work they're doing in a way that helps them develop their skills and also their awareness of each other. So we have a monthly gathering we call the Common Hour, where we focus on key topics relevant to everybody's work, like how to measure impacts,
mm-hmm.
as we discussed earlier, or how to think about the question of the word elite, and does the Aspen Institute have to adjust some of its offerings to be less elite?
Sometimes just the word Aspen in people's minds.
Exactly.
Just conveys elite.
Exactly. Other times we've had town hall meetings on particular topics, like, for instance, diversity, equity, inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have biweekly breakfast with me as CEO with 10 different colleagues every other week. And all these different efforts are about bringing more people into the work who are in the workforce to have them feel more of a stake in each other's work, to feel even more mutual dependency and joy in being colleagues together. Finally, I'd say that for every organization out there, and this is true of a family, this is true of a church, this is true of a synagogue, it's true of a business, true of a school. You have to think about what are some of those core values that you really want to work towards together. And in our case at the Aspen Institute, it's excellence with impact.
Mm-hmm.
It's being coherent and knowing each other's work, being able to describe our work well and honor each other's work by describing it well. It's sustainability by making sure that we are committed to helping the organization take care of itself financially and organizationally so it'll be stronger 15 years from now when we're all gone. And finally, aspiration, We want to do more for our public. We want to do more for our country.
Talk a little bit about your personal journey, Dan, to your current role at Aspen. And I guess that story almost has to begin with your mom. Tell us about her.
Well, I was so fortunate. I grew up in Baltimore City, and I was born in 1961. And my mom was a single mother and who went to college in her 30s at Towson College and while working during the day. And
you guys went to school together almost.
We almost went to school together. I graduated from sixth grade, and she graduated from college. And, of course, then it's like many other moms who go back to college a little bit later, she wanted another degree.
Oh, they keep on going.
Yep. So she got a master's degree when I was in high school in history, and then she got a PhD in history when I was in college. And my sister and I both really had the opportunity to go right to college after high school, whereas my mom and my dad both didn't go to college until they were in their 30s. Mm-hmm. And they were lucky. They had an affordable public commuter college they could go to at Towson, a very good school. They could afford it. They both got their degrees later in life. My dad was also, and he's still alive. My mom passed away. My dad also took care of our family by paying child support very regularly in a way that was like a team effort. My mom and dad divorced, both working and going to college, but doing their best as partners by their children. And so that taught me the value of cooperation, the central importance of family, and the incredible, almost religious belief in the power of education.
Yeah, an affordable education.
Exactly.
Eligible to everybody.
The thing about education is that you are better if I get it, and I am better if you get it. The whole society is lifted up when anyone in the society gets an education. It's the one thing of everything else. It's the one thing in a democracy that we must have, because a democracy is only as strong as its people, and its people are only able to flourish if they're able to develop the greatness that's inside of them and not feel that greatness is somehow snuffed out or kept within or never seen. And it takes education in many different forms, not one way, to allow young people to feel that what's inside of them can get out and they can grow and flourish and become a great person like they're called to be. And education is how we organize that process, that democratic process of allowing young people to grow into their adulthood and to grow into their adulthood proud of who they are and ready to give back to the society that created such a fine foundation for their own development.
Well, what's inside of you and is about to come out is a book. It's called Involve, and it's inspired by a quote by Benjamin Franklin. Tell us about the quote, then tell us about the book.
Ben Franklin was along with Frederick Douglass, I would argue, two of the most iconic American self-taught, self-educated people that helped create this incredible nation. And Franklin loved the idea of apprenticeship, and he loved the idea of helping young people. And so he had this quote that took the perspective of a student, and it said, "Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I know. Involve me and I learn." So my book is called Involve, and it's about the power and beauty in the college context of younger people and older people teaming up, because the older people involve themselves in the formation of the young people, teaming up to create learning and to create value that wouldn't happen except for both parties giving their best to the enterprise of education. And in particular, I argue in this book, in five chapters, that there are certain mindsets that students gain by going to college and being responsible for their education and taking care of themselves and getting up and going to class and doing all the things that an emerging adult has to do in college leads to the formation of five mindsets that are incredibly powerful for the rest of one's life. For example, the mindset that you are a learner, that you can create your learning, that someone doesn't give it to you, you don't buy it, you create it with your own effort. Any young person that develops that mindset in college or in any other way will never starve.
Yeah.
They will never feel they're not growing. They will never feel that they're stuck, because they'll know I can learn. So that's what the book is about. It's a celebration of young people and the glory of developing the talent within them.
Well, get working. I want to read it. And you're absolutely right. Don't wait for it to come to you. You got to go out there and you got to get it.
Exactly. Exactly.
Let me close with this, Dan. You were taught at Georgetown by your mentor, Father Timothy Healy, among others, the importance and potential of institutions to create positive, systemic change in society. But as many of our listeners out there know, we've lost a lot of faith in our institutions, the church, government, the media, the financial industry, and others. What do you believe the impact that has been on American society, and do you think that these and other institutions will ever regain Americans' trust?
Those institutions need to regain Americans' trust. That is one of their core functions, is to be able to hold the trust of the larger civic body and of individual Americans, because if our institutions are not trusted, our citizens will be left just retreating into whatever sort of, I don't know how to put it exactly, whatever enclave they can find.
Mm-hmm.
A working democracy needs all those institutions you just mentioned to deliver benefits to the people impartially, without discrimination or prejudice, with accountability for getting results, without corruption or waste or fraud or graft, or in some cases, in some institutions, abuse.
Mm.
And institutions have to be held accountable. And the people that work in them need to be held accountable if they're violating the sacred trust of those institutions. I do believe that one of the great strengths of America is that we have these institutions of a working press, of the private sector, of the financial industry, of schools and institutions, and of religious institutions that are not government entities. And that's key. I think strong non-governmental entities is the way the American system of free enterprise has been developed. And so if we love America, we believe we want to create a strong shared future, we should be investing in the institutions in our lives' ability to help the people of our country. And that's what the Aspen Institute is, one of the things we're really all about.
Well, Dan Porterfield, the president and CEO of the Aspen Institute, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. There are very few websites that are as rich or contain as much information as yours. Tell us what's there and how listeners can get involved in helping support your work.
Well, I hope that the listeners will go to the main website of the Aspen Institute, and where you could perhaps sign up to receive what's called the 5 Ideas of the Day, which are just a free email.
Go to it every day.
They send you some some fun articles. You might not read them all, but you might not read any of them for a week, but there are some good articles. Or you could look at go into the website and look at the Aspen Ideas Festival, which will be all of our panel discussions will be webcast and later stored on our website. And so you can see the dialogues that are happening this summer at our Ideas Festival. And then I think also I would encourage listeners and readers to look at the website the parts of our website that describe our individual programs, a few of which I mentioned today. I'm very proud of all my colleagues that work so hard to make a difference for the American people, to solve problems. And I think you'll find some pretty interesting material on that site.
I think you're right. Thanks, Dan. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Denver. Have a great day.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.